Do you remember we were talking about those ads last week?
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. So I had a good friend who will absolutely remain nameless reach out to me and said, I've been getting ads about... Do you know what Pink Cherry is?
No.
It's I had to look it up, but it's basically a male sex toy site.
Oh!
So not only are we getting airlines and all these other ads, we are
But I don't get anything cool. I just keep getting that stupid casino.
Okay, well, I was checking out some of these things, and I am blown away by some of the toys that exist in this world today. And there are two that I saved for you that I need to show you. So the first one...
I saved for you. Thanks!
The first one, just for this conversation. So the first one is the Serpentine Stroker. Do you see it in the corner of the screen?
Oh, why would you want that?
Do you see it?
Yes, I can see it.
So that's a thing. $44.99.
That looks like a child's toy.
It does. It looks like a hand puppet.
But yeah.
It's a snake head.
Yikes. Huh.
And then this one, I'm going to have to blur this when I show this on screen, but I didn't look up what it was called, but they just cut out images of females and just stick them behind the toy. Like, they're not even trying to make it good. Like, get Canva, people. It looks like she's riding in a log flume. She's, doesn't it?
Her hands are up like she's excited. They're going down like the mountain.
I saw this picture. I'm going, oh my God, I think I saw that at Six Flags the other day too.
Oh my God.
Anyway, the second part of his text was, I'm going to subliminally start sending these episodes to my wife because apparently things have been a little cold in the bedroom. So, hey, you know what? If we can help
perfect
Marriage Unscripted, we are now offering marital counseling through our ads.
Yikes.
And you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to episode 67 of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast in the history of the world. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, a 23-year veteran true crime producer, along with my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
Heyo.
It is the first week of the month, Melissa. September 2025 is here, and you know what that means.
New month, new block, new theme. Whoop, whoop.
Nope. Kids are back at school and NFL football is back.
I literally care about none of that.
Well, you better, because that's all I'm going to care about until February.
Oh, my God.
So... And in addition to that, you are half correct. We do have a new theme starting right now, and it's a pretty cool theme, I think. We're calling it The Case That Haunts Me.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting theme, and basically we're going to be highlighting cases that really affected people involved. And by people, we don't necessarily mean like the victims and their loved ones, but the investigators, the first responders, the medical examiners. And in one case that we're not confirmed about, but one case, even a film crew who attempted to create a documentary about a specific case, it was too much and the documentary was scrapped.
This is that ripple effect that we always talk about. I mean, this obviously the victims are front and center, their loved ones, and they're the most important part of these cases, because honestly, without the victims, you don't have a case. But When these things happen, there are so many people behind the scenes that are forced to see things, do things, hear things that nobody should have to see. And because it's essentially a job, you can't get wrapped up in the gore and the personal side of it. You just have a job to do.
No, I agree. I don't think I'd be able to do it. Just go from one to the other to the other. But you know who I always feel so bad for?
Ooh.
The crime scene cleanup crew. Like, I'm sure no one ever thinks about them, but oh my God, I can't imagine the things they've seen and the smells they've smelled. And I feel sick talking about it.
There's a guy on TikTok who actually just started a channel. That's what he does. And he can only show certain parts of it, but that's his whole TikTok channel is just crime scene cleanup.
I think that should be, we should have a guest come on, a crime scene cleanup guest at some point.
Well, I think that's an interesting concept. And our guest this month is not that far removed from that. So we will get into that maybe in a week or two. We'll kind of fill you guys in. But before we start, Melissa, should we make our big announcement?
Oh, hell yeah.
Let's do it. So starting in January 2026, we're going to kick off the new year. Murder Unscripted will be launching a Patreon.
Yay! We are super excited, not only because it will allow us to put out more content, but it will also give us a chance to connect with you guys on a more personal level.
Absolutely. Send us your ideas, guys, because if there's something you think would be cool for Patreon, maybe something another pod does or something that you're just really into, it could be completely off topic. Like, shoot us a message and tell us, because the extra stuff we're going to do for this is about you. And especially if you're paying for it, for lack of a, I mean, that's what it is. We want to give you exactly what you want.
For sure. The Patreon will be for you. So we want to know what you want. You can hit us up. You know where to find us, but I will remind y'all at the end.
Blue sky.
And once we have, yeah, right. And once we have things a little bit more figured out, we will update you. This is all very new.
Totally.
All right. Well, now that we've talked for a million years, I think it's time to get into my case. Quick trigger warning. This case is incredibly violent. Our victim was tortured. And I'm, of course, not going to go into crazy detail, but I am going to tell you what happened and the injuries she sustained, because I think that's an important part of the case. And it's important to understand just how sick our bad guy was or is.
True.
Real quick for my sources, in addition to a buttload of articles, I also watched a few shows. One was On the Case with Paula Zahn, season 24, episode 1. Another was Bloodline Detectives with Nancy Grace. Mm. And the other show I watched was actually a special edition of Homicide Hunter with the beloved Joe Kenda. And no, everybody knows who he is. A national treasure, that's who.
That is a fact. Do you know about the Kenda cruise?
Yes, I want to go. They did one where it was Joe Kenda and his wife, and then Carl Marino, who played him in the show, and his wife.
Yeah.
Stop.
How cool, right? Just sail the seven seas with Joe Kenda.
Yeah, and they'd be trapped on there so they couldn't get away from me. Well, if you want to check out the Joe Kenda special, it's part of Homicide Hunter, but it's like its own very special 2-hour episode entitled Homicide Hunter, Never Give Up.
Oh, cool.
But I do want to warn you that the guy who plays Joe Kenda in the Homicide Hunter series, sexy as Carl Marino, he is not in this special. So they have some other dude. I know. And I'm sure this other guy's a lovely gentleman, but he just isn't as magical as Carl. So just keep that in mind, because I was disappointed.
I don't know. I'm still like not convinced that you don't have some kind of actual crush on Joe Kenda.
I never said I didn't. Anyway.
Like the real Joe Kenda, not the not
Carl Marino. I never said I didn't.
Wow.
Anyway. Well, one more note about the Joe Kenda special. They seem to have the date of the crime wrong.
Oh.
Like every source says our victim died on the morning of March 17th, but the Kenda special says it was the morning of March 18th.
Hmm.
So that's strange.
It is strange.
But the victim's headstone says 17th, so that's what we're going with. So, Kenda, I'm sorry. I still love you. It's fine. Well, for this case, we are in Colorado Springs, Colorado. It is St. Patty's Day, and it is cold outside. And Colorado Springs had just gotten a bit of snow in the early morning hours of March 17th, and the temperature is still in the mid-20s, which is well below freezing.
Yeah, that's freaking cold.
Yeah. So it's about 5:15 in the morning and it's still dark out, and Colorado Springs police officer John Taylor and his partner, Officer Lance, they've been working all night. It's almost shift change. They're just kind of finishing up. So they decide to drive through the strip center located at 2710 South Academy Boulevard, which nowadays it's known as Hancock Plaza. I don't know what if it was back then. And it's like a regular strip center. Like, I pulled it up on Google, and today there's a Jimmy John's, there's Great Clips, a grocery store, a Dollar Tree.
Oh, man, your fave.
So my fave. $1.25 tree, I guess. Anyway.
Yeah, now.
Well, at the time of our case, and again, it's March 1987, there was a restaurant bar kind of thing named the Korean Club Restaurant. So the officers drive around the strip center, so they're in the back of all the stores. And when they get to that side, specifically behind the Korean club, they see something laying on the ground next to a dumpster. The officers are in the shows, and the one guy's like, I thought it was a mannequin. Which I'm like, sir, are you, what? Every crime junkie knows it's never a mannequin.
But how many mannequins have you ever seen just lying around? Like, I would think body before mannequin. Like, if I saw something, I'd be like, that's a body. And I would never say that's a mannequin. Who the hell leaves mannequins laying around?
I think it's your brain trying to, like, pick the not worst case scenario. Like, I think it's unconscious, but, like, no, I get it. I don't think I'd ever be like, hey, look at that mannequin.
I've never seen a mannequin on the street.
No.
No.
But I've also never seen a dead body on the street.
Oh, that's true. Okay, good point.
To be fair. Well, as the officers get closer, they realize it is not a mannequin, but it is the nude body of a young woman. And they jump out of their cruiser and run over to the victim, and they are immediately horrified by the state of this Jane Doe. She has clearly been brutally attacked and tortured. So at 5:20 a.m., they radio dispatch to report a DB, which means dead body.
Pretty cryptic.
I know. So by 6 a.m., the little shopping center is swarming with law enforcement, including our man, Sergeant Kenda. And just like Officer Taylor and Officer Lands, even the seasoned detectives on this case were taken aback by the level of violence. And in case you weren't putting two and two together, this case is one of the cases that haunted Joe Kenda. And not only him, but also the Colorado Springs Police Department, the Army Criminal Investigation Division, the Fort Carson Military Base, and of course, the victim's heartbroken family.
Why so much military involved?
We'll get there. Oh. Pump the brakes.
Sorry.
So, as I said, this case really haunted Kenda, and of the 387 cases that he worked, he has a 92% case closure rate.
Wow.
Like, this is one of those 8% that he couldn't solve. That's 8%.
That's nuts. Like, that's even 8%, though. That's still an amazing stat. You're solving 92% of your cases. That's pretty darn good.
I, like, got goosebumps when I was typing that.
Yeah.
But cool. I won't make you wait until the end to tell you that this case is eventually solved, but not until 2019.
Oh, wow.
And Kenda actually gets called to testify in 2021. So we'll get there eventually.
That wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. So back to our Jane Doe, detectives do not touch a thing until their forensic tech, a man named Charlie Green, arrives. And this man received much adoration from Kenda, who I trust indefinitely as a good judge of character.
Yikes.
So this Charlie guy, he documents the scene, and they actually even had it videotaped, and they began inspecting the scene very carefully. So our victim is lying on her back, kind of leaning to the left with one arm laying so her hand is like above her head.
Okay.
And the episode of the Homicide Hunter show, it shows a crime scene video. And her face is blurred out, but you can see her laying there and you can see the victim's brown hair like blowing in the wind.
Oh, wow.
And it's really scary almost because the background is like snow and mountains and it's all very gray.
That's like super haunting imagery. Yeah, you're right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. Just seeing like the hair blow, I was like, oh, I got chills.
Yeah, that's creepy.
So our victim's gray pants are pulled down and bunched around one ankle. She's missing a sock. And there was a black dress boot standing up, like standing up. How do I explain this? It's standing up like straight.
Like it's on the sole's on the ground and it's just.
Yeah. Investigators quickly realized that robbery was not the motive here. Our victim had her watch still on, and she had a diamond ring on her left ring finger. So from the looks of her body, they knew this crime was sexually motivated.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, and they knew that she had been tortured. And according to sources, this is graphic AF. If you don't want to hear it, skip ahead 30 seconds. But our Jane Doe had a black eye. It looked like her nose was broken. She had multiple bite marks on her body, including her left breast. Her right nipple had been bitten clear off.
Damn.
Yeah, which they do believe this injury was post-mortem, thank God.
They still.
Still. She had a ton of defensive wounds. Like, this young woman fought. Her cause of death was homicide by ligature strangulation. So, in addition to all the injuries I just told you, our victim had a leather strap or a rope tied around her neck. Sources differed. So that was tied around her neck. And then she also had metal coat hangers wrapped around her head and neck in her mouth. Like, picture a horse's bridle.
Wow. What? That's so much overkill.
Oh my gosh. So wow. The coat hangers are twisted together at the back of her head. And they had caught, like, to make it tighter.
Yeah, he was using it for control, whoever it was.
Yes.
Wow.
And it had caused several injuries to, like, her face and inside her mouth. Like, it had torn her mouth.
I thought you weren't going into crazy detail.
I'm still not, I swear.
Wow.
And sadly, our victim had been viciously raped, both vaginally and anally. The sexual assault was actually so violent. She had blunt force trauma to her liver and spleen.
Good God.
Take a minute to process that. This young woman was absolutely just tortured.
I am no psychologist, in case you weren't aware.
You are?
I have worked on a number of shows where this level of overkill was present. And I do know that it often stems from a couple different things. So one, I feel like a lot of times they get off on it. It's a very simple explanation. It's all about power and control. They can do things at their own pace when you have that kind of control, like prolonging it for their own gratification. And the postmortem nipple thing kind of goes with that. Like, if the victim is dead, that's the ultimate control, you know, like they no longer have to worry about anybody fighting back, like literally do whatever they want. And the other big thing is a lot of times these people were abused as children, or they have some kind of misplaced anger toward women. And maybe that's they were broken up with. Maybe they constantly get rejected by women. Maybe they have like an ex who they're just still furious at or something like that. And this person is the next in line to just for them to take their rage out on.
Well, hold on to that thought. So our victim's laying on some dirt and gravel, and the investigators, they didn't believe she was killed where she was found. There was really no signs of a struggle. There was no blood. You know, it didn't happen there.
Yeah.
So in addition to not knowing where the crime happened, investigators were puzzled because there was dirt and like straw on her body, which was not consistent with the area where our Jane Doe was found.
Big sure thing that she wasn't.
Absolutely. So they believe she had been killed somewhere else, and then the killer may have brought our victim behind the shopping center, planning on disposing of her body in that dumpster she was laying near. But the dumpster was actually locked.
Oh, very nice. So he just left her there, kind of alone and cold. Very nice guy.
Horrible. So surrounding her body were three cigarette butts, and they were pretty new looking. Like, it doesn't look like they had been out in the weather for a while, which means our killer dumped our victim and then hung out there smoking cigarettes. Like, why? To admire your work?
We did a whole block on this. Hedonistic killers, thrill killers.
Mm-hmm.
Narcissism is another trait that these guys all exhibit. Like, when they do this, they see their crimes as, how do you explain it? Like, proof of how intelligent they are, I guess. Like, some kind of twisted validation.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, it is.
Well, back to Jane Doe. Luckily, investigators didn't have to do too much digging to figure out who our victim was. Remember how I said, like, her boot was up by her head?
Yeah.
Well, underneath that boot was a Colorado driver's license. Our Jane Doe was 20-year-old Darlene DePaula Kraschak.
She was a baby. 20
years old. I know.
Yeah.
And I will say the detectives kind of felt like the killer specifically left the license there almost to taunt them. Like, because it was it was like perfectly placed right under the shoe. So you pick it up, you see that immediately.
Catch me if you can.
Yep. So at the time of her murder, Darlene, whose nickname was Crash, like because her last name was Kraschak.
Yeah, Crash. I was just going to say Crash.
She was an active duty soldier and she was stationed at Fort Carson, which is a military base. Yeah. So that's a military base. And it's like on the southern outskirts of Colorado Springs. Apparently, there's a couple military bases right around there. So Darlene was ranked as a specialist and she was assigned to the 73rd Maintenance Company. And Darlene had hailed from Maryland. She was born in Baltimore on August 22nd, 1966, to parents Paul and Betty Lou Kreshock. She had two sisters, Rhonda and Lucy, and I believe Darlene was the youngest of the three. And there was like one source that said Rhonda was a half-sister, but I don't want to say that definitively. I just know that her mom, Betty, talked about the two sisters and how close all three girls were on the Paula Zahn episode. I don't have a ton about Darlene's childhood, which bums me out because I love learning about the victims and like talking about them. But I do know that she and her mom, Betty, were especially close. Like in one of the shows, Betty tearfully says, "We were best friends."
Wow.
So when I did get to learn a little bit about Darlene, I was reading about her and it sounds like she was so kind-hearted and free-spirited. Apparently she was a tomboy and she loved working on big trucks and just like being around them. Like she wanted to drive big rigs, which
that's kind of cool.
It's so cool. Like it isn't something most little girls dream of. So I was what a cool chick.
I could be a princess. I could be this. Or I could be a truck driver.
And that's what she wanted. She was going after it.
Good for her.
And her dad, Paul, said that Darlene had a lot of pride in her country. She knew that the military could teach her how to work on and even drive those big rigs. So when she decided she wanted to join the military and follow in her father's footsteps, well, her parents were proud, but they also tried to talk her out of it. But Darlene was undeterred, and multiple sources talked about how she really came into her own once she was in the military. She kind of blossomed and became this strong, confident, like badass beauty.
Good for her.
Yeah. And I mean, to be a woman in the military, especially back in the 1980s, like.
I actually just did a story about this that I learned. That's so crazy you brought that up. So back in the 80s, there were only, I want to say 10% of active military personnel were female.
Wow.
So she was definitely like one of the select few.
Yeah.
Wow.
So investigators obviously know they have their work cut out for them. Once they document everything at the scene, they start meticulously collecting the evidence. They bag those three cigarette butts. They bag Darlene's clothing and that boot. They also take soil samples from the area where her body was laying and like underneath her. So while they're doing this, meanwhile, her body had been taken for an autopsy and her body was essentially frozen, and this next part's a little intense, but in the show, Kenda talks about how fluids deposited in the body, such as seminal fluids, they can be frozen in the body, and then as everything thaws out, the fluids drain onto the table, which they are then able to collect.
That's wild, and it makes total sense, and honestly, it's never something I really thought about because I don't have a lot of frozen female victims. I don't cover stories that, you know what I mean? That's a very rare thing to see.
Yeah, absolutely. When he said that, I was like, it makes total sense.
Yeah.
So swabs were collected from these fluids as well as from her body, which is some brilliant foresight. Because remember, this is in 87. DNA was not widely known about, nor was it understood.
Right.
And I want to give so much credit to Kenda and his team because in the show, the team who worked on this case 30 plus years after it happened, they were so impressed and pleased with the amount of evidence that was taken and like how it had been preserved back in 87.
It's awesome when they have the foresight to do that because they don't know. Maybe they've heard about it on the horizon, but a lot of people have just done what they've done for decades and just kind of raw dog it, like no gloves,
yeah.
No nothing. Yeah.
Well, and another thing I was just going to say, not only were they so meticulous about preserving and collecting, but they were also really careful. They wore masks. They wear gloves. They knew that they could potentially contaminate evidence if they didn't wear that stuff.
That's so important. That's good. If that helps solve the case, the credit should go to those guys as much as anybody.
Without that evidence, this case would never have been solved. So it's pretty incredible. So not that he needs it, but kudos to Kenda. Just love him.
God.
I want to look into those big, beautiful blue eyes and hear him say, my, my, my.
Knock it off.
Well, my, my, my.
I love when he says that.
What is it called when you have an old person fetish? Because you're that. You're whatever that is.
It's you're gross. An old person. So get over it.
You're right.
So the next step on the investigators' agenda, they begin going to the different stores in the strip center to see if anyone recognized Darlene. and unfortunately, nobody remembered seeing her. However, the staff at the Korean Club restaurant, they said they had closed up at about 2 a.m. They left the building and walked to their vehicles around 2:20 a.m., which were parked by that dumpster. And they were adamant that Darlene's body had not been there when they left at 2:20 a.m.
Well, yeah, because when you're at a restaurant, when you work there, the last thing you do is take the trash out, like on your way to the car. So,
right.
And if she was right by the dumpster, they 100% would have seen her.
Yeah, you couldn't miss her. She was like right in front of it.
Right.
So police now have the beginning of a time frame, and they realize that there are fresh tire tracks in the snow near Darlene's body.
Ooh.
And I don't know the exact time it started snowing, but apparently it did begin falling lightly pretty early that morning. Okay. Which meant that she had to have been dumped behind the shopping center sometime after the snow began falling, which means they believe she was at least dumped between 2:30 a.m.-ish and 5:15-ish when those two officers found her. And because she was so frozen, I think their theory was that she had been there for at least a few hours.
It's nice that that window is tight, because now when they do mm-hmm. start to interview people, that's a really small window. So you got a great start with that. And I assume they also would have needed at some point, if knowing that she's active military, would have had to notify CID.
They did. You are absolutely right. So they called it into the Army's Criminal Investigation Division. I didn't know what that meant, honestly. So I looked it up, and the CID is the Army's primary federal law enforcement agency. And they're responsible for investigating serious crimes involving military personnel mm-hmm. and Department of Defense civilians.
That's 100% true.
So learn something new every day. The Colorado Springs Police Department and the CID, they worked this entire investigation together. And I was so pleasantly surprised to see how well they shared information, like instead of letting that bullshit ego and territorial nonsense get in the way like we see often. These two groups, they joined forces from day one on that cold day back in 1987 all the way till the day this shitbag was sentenced in July of 2021.
See, it's different for some reason when it involves military, and it's not like two local PDs fighting for jurisdiction. Like, I don't know why, but every case I've ever dealt with when the CID is involved, it's always a symbiotic relationship. Like, these two agencies always play nice together. So bravo to them. But they have always looked good in my eyes.
Yeah, they were great. And it seems like especially the investigators, like later on in 2020 and 2021, they just got along so well.
Nice.
So that was really nice to see. So an Army sergeant back in Maryland had to break the news to Darlene's poor parents. And both of her parents, Paul and Betty, they're in the Homicide Hunter episode, and they talk about hearing that Darlene had been killed, and they're completely shocked, but they're also confused. She wasn't deployed. There was no conflict going on at the time. They're like, how on earth could she have been killed? That part hit me kind of hard, because I think if you're going into the military, there is a clear thought of danger, but I think that danger is from war.
That's
like,
fair.
Not from going out for a drink with your friends.
Well, sadly though, military or not, like, I feel like that's what you need to worry about when you're a female, especially an attractive one. Like, I know that's like a pretty broad sweeping statement, but am I wrong?
No, you're 100% right. I do get that. I don't know that it was as understood in 87 though.
No,
maybe
that's probably true too.
So when police in Colorado Springs are able to speak to Darlene's parents further, they mention the diamond ring on her finger. And her parents explain that, yes, Darlene had been married at one point to another Fort Carson soldier named Glenn Geringer. And Darlene and Glenn had kind of had a whirlwind courtship, and they got carried away and married and quickly realized they weren't compatible. So at this time, like, of her murder, their divorce proceedings were actually set to be finalized, just like in a few days.
Red herring alert, anybody?
Uh-huh. And investigators immediately are like, is Glenn angry about this divorce? Is he angry enough to take it out on her?
Hmm?
And then they discover that Glenn is the beneficiary to Darlene's substantial Army surviving spouse benefit.
Oh man, double red herring alert.
Right? So they are really interested in talking with him.
Red flags are whipping.
They are all over. However, when they bring Glenn in, they find him to be, they tell him what happened, and they find him to be shocked, upset, confused, like all of the emotions that are pretty standard in a situation like this. Yeah. And they also found out that he had a girlfriend who he was really happy with. He and Darlene, there was really no bad blood there. And not only did this guy have a girlfriend, but he had been with her the entire night before. She could alibi him and so on. Now, they do compare his teeth to the bite marks on her body, and they took a blood sample. And, you know, on and on until they were able to finally rule him out.
When we do cases that have dental matches and stuff and forensic odontology, they're just some of the coolest stories. I just love that science. And I know it's not exact, and it's they're kind of weeding it out as an approved science. But I think it's awesome because, I mean, it's not quite a fingerprint, but man, when those, if you have messed up teeth and they line up, that's pretty damning.
I mean, that's what caught Bundy.
Yeah. And we got something coming up in January, actually, that is going to fit right into that little box.
Ooh, I don't even know what that is. So
I know.
So they're able to weed out Glenn. He didn't do it. And I want to mention this next part. However, I'm not completely sure of the validity of it. I heard on another podcast several things about this case that I could not for the life of me find anywhere else. Not in any of the three shows I watched, not in any of the reports I found, not even in the arrest affidavits. And I did reach out to this podcast and ask for their sources, but as of this recording, I have not heard anything. But this podcast mentioned that Darlene was engaged at the time of her death to another soldier, but he was like stationed somewhere else.
Interesting.
So I don't know if that's true. And there were a couple other things that the podcast mentioned, but I don't feel comfortable adding them because I couldn't confirm them.
Then why'd you add that if you can't confirm it?
Well, because I'm saying maybe that she was, and I want to point it out because this guy could have been a potential.
Got it.
Suspect. But regardless, the maybe fiance had nothing to do with the murder, so we can move on.
I hope you're sitting down because this may shock you, but believe it or not, some podcasts just say whatever they want because they heard it somewhere.
Like when they claim that they're the most immersive.
Yes, see? We can't back. I got no sources for that. I don't even think we're that immersive now that I think about it. Because we went to a crime scene twice.
Anyway. So Darlene's mother, Betty, tells investigators about a very concerning phone call that she had had with Darlene just about a week prior to her murder. Up until this phone call, Darlene had been loving life. She was doing great in the military. She enjoyed her work. She was really popular in her unit and among her friends. But on this phone call, she asked her mom, "Mom, what do you think about me coming home?"
Cue the crow. That is an ominous statement.
Yeah. And Betty was taken aback because A, why all of a sudden did Darlene want to come home? And B, she couldn't legally leave the military at that time. So Betty asked Darlene, like, what is going on? And Darlene told her, "I can't tell you." And Betty is like, "What do you mean you can't tell me? Like, you tell me everything." And
yeah, your best friends.
Yeah, and Betty says in one of the shows, she's like, "She told me things that no kid should tell their parent. Why couldn't she tell me this?"
That's a sign of a great relationship, though.
Yeah. So investigators take this information. They look into everything in Darlene's life, through her personnel file, everything. But they could never, even to this day, find anything that would have wanted, like, caused her to want to leave.
I think that she was in danger, but if not, she was definitely something important that she didn't want to tell her mom. But that's strange that they never figured it out.
Yeah. And I mean, for a long time, they thought that maybe she had seen something that she shouldn't have seen and someone killed her to silence her. But ultimately, they never figured out what it was. So that was kind of another dead end, unfortunately. So their next step is to visit Fort Carson and find out where Darlene had been the night prior to her death. So they begin by speaking to fellow soldiers in her unit, including her best friend from home, a woman named Carolyn Smith. So Carolyn and Darlene had been friends for years, and they actually had enlisted together and went out to Fort Carson together. And while I don't think Carolyn was ever really a person of interest, they are interested in talking to her because, as Kenda puts it, quote, "We are well aware that 20-year-old girls tend to bump their gums with friends," end quote.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I just thought it's so funny. Like, what the hell does bumping gums mean?
That's
it sounds
freaking
dirty.
Hilarious. I would think that would mean kissing, or does that mean chat?
No, I think
like
it
being
means
chatty?
Fighting.
Oh, what? I was going to use that as a come on line. I would probably be like, hey, you want to bump gums?
Oh, you'll get shot down just like always.
Yeah, seriously. Wow, I have never heard that term.
Sometimes Kenda has the best sayings, and I'm like, oh wow. My God. But wow. I was like, I don't know what that means.
Amazing.
Well, when they speak to Carolyn, she explains that she had seen Darlene at about 2 p.m. on the day before her death. And with this information, investigators discover that the day prior, all non-essential service members had been dismissed early due to inclement weather. It was super cold, below freezing. And according to Carolyn, Darlene was going to go out that night with some guys from her unit. And as this was the day before St. Patty's Day, many of the soldiers decided to use their unexpected snow day to kind of let loose and blow off some steam.
I would too. Especially St. Patty's, that's a big party day to begin with. You throw a bonus day on that, party on.
Yeah. Everybody's Irish on St. Patty's
Hell
Day.
Hell yeah, they are.
So Darlene and two men in her unit, Sergeant Eric Lord, who was her squad leader, and Specialist Tim Robinson. So the three friends spend the evening at a club bar called Shuffles. And I saw some pictures of it back in 87, and it had a decent-sized bar and, like, a really big dance floor.
Cool.
So this club was located at 1861 South Academy Boulevard in Colorado Springs. FYI, I Googled it. Shuffles is no longer there. The address is listed as Pho Buddy, a Vietnamese restaurant. Oh. And it has 4 out of 5 stars on Google, so check it out.
I always thought it'd be funny to open up a all-night pho shop. 24/7. Like, oh. That's what you call your store. Oh my God.
You and your dad jokes. Well, anyway, Darlene went to Shuffles that night with Eric and Tim, and they had a blast. Darlene and Tim like danced their butts off. They drank. They just had a really good time. And actually, Darlene was having such a good time that when Eric said, "Okay, it's getting late, we gotta go," Darlene was like, "Nope, I'm staying. I'm having fun. I'm staying."
Oh no.
And Eric's in some of the shows, and he talks about how he and Darlene kind of got in an argument. And he was like, "We need to go. We have to be up early for formation, and I'm your ride home, so let's go."
Yeah.
But Darlene was adamant that she wanted to stay. And she told Eric and Tim that the man she had been seen talking to and having a drink with would give her a ride home.
Oh, boy. I see where this is heading. Mm-hmm.
Well, neither Eric nor Tim got this man's name, but they quickly and correctly assumed he was a fellow soldier. And Eric would later describe the man as having beady eyes. So remember that. After a bit more back and forth between Eric and Darlene, Eric and Tim like begrudgingly left the bar without Darlene and headed towards the base. And just for geographical reference, we have the three locations that we know of: Fort Carson, the shopping center where Darlene was found, and then Shuffles, the club. So Fort Carson is like the most southern of the three. And then the shopping center was about 15 minutes north of the base. And then Shuffles was like 4 or 5 minutes north of the shopping center.
Got it.
So investigators find out that she was with them. So they obviously want to talk to Eric and Tim.
Yeah.
So Kenda actually interviews Eric, and another detective interviews Tim. And they asked the men, "What happened after you left the bar?" Their stories were consistent. They said they left the bar, they headed towards base. Tim wanted to hit another bar that was like located right outside of Fort Carson. So Eric dropped him off and he went back to his barracks. I think he was living on base at the time. And that was that. So investigators asked both men to basically strip down. Because remember, I said that Darlene had several defensive wounds.
Yeah.
And the investigators knew that whoever had killed her had to have been covered in scratches.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they check Eric's body. Nothing to see. They still, though, they take his bite impressions. No match. And then they also take a sample of his blood and saliva. Mm-hmm. In addition to taking head hair, body hair, and pubic hair.
Yeah. You gotta, if you're going to do that, you collect everything just in case.
And they definitely did. And I think that Kenda believed Eric's story from the jump because Eric was clearly suffering from survivor's guilt.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to feel bad knowing that you left your comrade at the bar, you know, and now she's dead. He's got to be guilt-ridden to this day.
Even in the Homicide Hunter special, like, my heart broke for this man. He was so remorseful, and he just seems to live with so much guilt that he didn't fight Darlene harder to leave.
Sure. And I know you want to let somebody be that, like, they're adults, they can make their own decisions, yes. But man, hindsight.
It's so hard. And in the episode, he goes, I should have picked her up and thrown her in the car. One simple movement and everything would have been different. Eric Lord, if you ever randomly come across this episode, you didn't do anything wrong. You didn't hurt Darlene, and you could never have known what was going to happen. Like, I just imagine the weight of the world has been on that man's shoulders since the moment he found out. So by now, Eric's ruled out. So let's get on to Tim. As I said, his story about the night and what happened after they left the bar is consistent with Eric's story. But when Tim takes his shirt off, his back looks like he was attacked by a wild tiger.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And investigators are like, nice scratch marks. You want to tell us what happened to me? So Tim is adamant that the scratches were from consensual sex with a woman he had been seeing. She liked to get a little rough, which I'm like, get it, girl.
I mean, we all have our thing, but third degree finger gouges aren't exactly, I don't know, that's next level.
Yeah, whatever. So they're looking at Tim's body and they're like, you kind of seem like a strong suspect. Like, you're the last one to see Darlene. You're covered in scratches. But when they end up following up with his lady friend, she confirms the scratches are from her. So again, I say, get it, girl. Do you?
No. Stop getting it. Maybe I'm just a delicate flower. I think that's what it is.
You are. So they also compare Tim's bite impression to the bite marks on Darlene. And again, no match. But they still take blood and saliva samples along with head, body, and pubic hair. And just like with Eric, Tim is quickly ruled out. So I mentioned about the investigators taking the blood samples. Kenda was incredibly adamant about getting blood samples from everyone.
And that's, you know what? That's expensive. The department, that'll eat at your budget real quick.
Right. But he fought to have this done. Like, he wanted to create a database of biological samples. I feel like he was so ahead of his time. And he argued just with, I guess, his superiors, like, how important that this was. And he won because they took them. They got blood samples from everyone. And these samples were carefully and meticulously preserved, just like all the other evidence.
Very cool. That's great to hear about, especially in that day and age.
Absolutely. So now that the ex-husband and the friends have been ruled out, Kenda and his team are like, hey, what the hell do we do now? So they head back to Shuffles, the club or bar where Darlene had been, to speak to the bartenders who worked that night. And they know this is going to be tough because there could have been 100 people in that bar. Like, how would a bartender remember a random patron? And unfortunately, the bartender didn't. So the investigators start the arduous task of tracking other club patrons, and they actually were able to track down a decent amount of people. But no one really had any helpful information other than Darlene left the bar between 12 a.m. and 1 a.m., but nobody knew who the man was that she was with. So 9 days into the investigation, Kenda and his team get a phone call from the CID, and they have some interesting info. In their custody, they have a man named Brian Jackson, and Brian's name changes depending on what TV show you're watching, but he is not a good dude. This guy has been charged with sexual assault offenses against female soldiers in his infantry.
Oh.
Not a good guy.
No.
So apparently when he went to meet with his attorney about these charges, he made some disturbing admissions of guilt regarding Darlene's murder. And his attorney felt incredibly uncomfortable. So
what'd he say?
He just kept saying that he had something to do with it. It was his fault. And the attorney's like, So he very carefully, because he can't break attorney-client privilege.
Right.
So he somehow carefully passed this information to the CID. So they brought him in. So Kenda and his team are like, we will be right there. in the meantime, the CID was looking into this guy, and he was a soldier at Fort Carson. They found out he owned a truck, which was on base. And I didn't know this, but apparently the military is allowed to search their people's cars, like, whenever they want, or I guess all stuff. Like,
it's in the fine print.
Yeah, exactly. They don't need those pesky search warrants like cops do. And when they search his truck, can you guess what they find?
Press-on nails?
Wire hangers.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Remember, that's what was on her face.
That's not a good look.
No. They also find straw in his car, which is strange, because remember, that was on her body.
He's a great suspect, if it's not him.
Yeah. Well, Kenda interrogates Brian Jackson, and he quickly realizes that Brian is just a dipshit. Or as Kenda puts it, not the sharpest knife in the drawer.
That expression ever.
Yes. Brian would say something and then he would backpedal and blah, blah, blah. And he claimed that it was his fault because he had been at the bar that night and he didn't save her from getting murdered. Like, it was this convoluted, idiotic statement that he kept making.
I know people like this.
Yeah. He just wanted to, like, involve himself. But after they talked to him and they did compare his teeth to the bite marks and he passed a polygraph, he was ruled out. And sadly, that is where Darlene's case went cold. And this part of the Homicide Hunter episode just done fucked me up. Like, I texted you. I'm sitting there watching this part. It's like 6:30 in the morning. I'm sitting in the dark on my laptop with the dogs asleep next to me. And I'm crying like a baby because Kenda is sitting there. He's talking about having to mark this case as an inactive homicide investigation and having to box up the hundreds and hundreds of pages in the case file, and his big blue eyes well up with tears, and he says,
"I felt I had done everything in my power to find out who killed her. I didn't do it. I didn't find out. There's a price to pay for that. Nightmares, all sorts of fun things. But reality sets in. There are other mothers that have lost loved ones that need our attention."
Just hearing that, could your heart break any more for this angel of
a
man?
That is sad. He's a good dude.
Yeah. And then he goes on to say, quote, "I would come into work early every morning. I would make up coffee and I would walk to the doorway of the cold case library. I'd look at every book and then I would beat myself up for being the dumb shit who doesn't know who killed those people." End quote. Way to rip my heart out and stomp on it, Joe Kenda.
That's a sign of a good detective, and that's who you want on your loved one's case.
Well, as I said, he and his team were forced to move on to the next homicide, and then the next, and then the next. And eventually, on September 1st, 1996, Lieutenant Joseph Kenda retired. But he never forgot about Darlene, and really, he never forgot about any of those 8% of cases that he couldn't close. So we're leaving 1987 and we're fast forwarding to 2004.
Okay.
So DNA is a thing. It's not as advanced as it is now, but it's getting there.
That's those weird in between years where they always retest and never get a hit.
Exactly. Well, in 2004 and then again in 2011, they did reopen Darlene's case for lab testing. They submitted evidence and the lab came back with an unknown DNA profile for a male. So they're pumped about that, but when they run this profile through CODIS, nothing comes up.
Not surprised. The CODIS was still being
super new,
Yeah, it was super new.
It was still being built up. They also compared the DNA to the men they had spoken to back in 1987, like Eric, Tim, that wackadoodle Brian.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Kenda had insisted on all those blood samples, so they had everything, but again, no matches. So each time Darlene's case goes back on the shelf and just is colder than a Colorado winter. So we're going to jump ahead again to 2016. And this is when the Colorado Springs Cold Case Unit decides to review Darlene's case. So Detective Jim Isham and Detective Jeremy Samosky, they start going through the case file, which at this point is like thousands of pages.
I'm sure. It's a lot of years.
So many. And they take more items for DNA testing, and they continued coming back with the same profile that they got in 2004 and 2011, which is great because that means more DNA on each piece of evidence, it all matches.
But they still don't know who that is.
Correct. It's still an unknown profile.
Right.
In 2017, so the following year, Special Agent Jessica Veltri with the CID, she joined the investigation and she decided to reach out to Parabon Nanolabs.
Ah, Parabon.
And as any true crime junkie lover knows, Parabon can take DNA and use it to create a snapshot of what someone may look like based on their DNA. So in March 2017, the 30th anniversary of Darlene's murder, the investigators were able to get a reward together and they released the Parabon snapshot. With the snapshot, they provided the picture of what the guy might have looked like when he was 25. Mm-hmm. And then they did an age progression version of what he might look like at 55.
I love those snapshots. They're so cool.
So cool. They got a ton of tips, but nothing concrete. And like over all these years, they're still running the DNA profile through CODIS and they get nothing.
Like, how on earth did this monster do what he did to Darlene, but then never commit another crime? Or at least, I guess at least another felony to land in the system. But this unknown male is this like sadist monster. And mm-hmm. that kind of craziness just doesn't go away or spawn out of nowhere.
And that's exactly how they felt. They were like, how is this guy not in CODIS? Like, how has he not gotten caught for something else?
Crazy.
So now it's 2019. So we're getting even further and further. So Special Agent Veltri, Detective Isham, and Detective Samosky had heard about genetic genealogy, which for anyone who's been living under a rock, genetic genealogy is using DNA and family trees to figure out how people are related. Specifically in crime cases, police compare DNA from a crime scene to DNA that's loaded in public databases, such as 23andMe and Ancestry.com. So they compare the unknown DNA to these databases, and if they find a match to a relative, they can build a family tree and narrow it down, like person by person, to identify the suspect.
So cool.
So they decide, you know what, let's do it. So Special Agent Veltri reached back out to Parabon Nanolabs. She sent them 27 pieces of evidence. 27. Wow. Yeah. The cigarette butts had like the most DNA, like they were the most useful, apparently.
I'm surprised the lab accepted 27 pieces of evidence. Usually there's pushback on that.
Yeah, I don't know. But maybe they didn't test every single one. I just know that she sent that many. Mm-hmm. And a few months later, she gets an email. They found a match. They had the name of the monster who tortured, raped, and murdered 20-year-old Army Specialist Darlene Krashak.
Amazing. Who is it?
Michael David White, W-H-Y-T-E, White.
Okay.
Special Agent Veltri calls Isham and Samosky, and she was like, we got him. And I have to imagine that the news like literally took their breath away. 32 years of chasing a ghost, and now they have him.
I absolutely love when it's somebody who detectives have never heard of. You know, they come out of the blue because it validates the fact that they didn't screw up, that this wasn't somebody just buried in the file that they overlooked or that they ruled out. So that's awesome.
100%. And they had the same question, though. They're like, who the hell is Michael David White? He was never a suspect. He was never spoken to. His name had never once been mentioned by anyone.
And on the flip side of that, it does suck because it shows that it was somebody you missed early on.
Yeah.
That, you know, so 30, whatever, how many years have passed at this point?
Yeah, that's so true. At the time of Darlene's murder back in 87, he was 26 years old.
Wow.
So they dig into his background and they find out that Michael White had been in the military. So according to that arrest affidavit, White had enlisted in 1979, and he served as a signal operations manager in the U.S. Army Signal Regiment.
That's a mouthful.
It is. And he had traveled like all over the world. Like he had been in Hawaii, all across the U.S. He'd been in Japan at one point.
Neat.
And then he eventually retired from the military in 1998. But can you guess where he was stationed from September of 1986 to August of 87?
I'm guessing Fort Carson.
Ding, 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 ding. At the time of Darlene's murder, White lived just 3 miles from that strip center where her body was found with his now ex-wife, Hilda. They had divorced at some point, I believe in like the late 1980s. After he retired from the military, he worked at a telecommunications company. So in 2019, he was living in an upper middle class suburb of Denver with his second wife. But get this shit. As far as we know, White had never committed another crime.
What?
The man had, no, listen, the man had one parking ticket on his record his entire life.
That is quite the leap from a parking ticket to what he did to her. Good
Isn't
Lord.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah, that's wild.
Now, I did see some Reddit theories of other murders that happened that people are like, did he do it? But, you know, it's all just theories.
I'd be curious to see what the statistics are on that, about monsters like this who have not committed any other crime. That would be a good question for, like, Catherine Ramsland or whoever, like, Buzz.
Yeah, we should ask them for sure.
Because I imagine it's not many.
No, you have to, because, I mean, I feel like people escalate, not de-escalate.
Exactly, or not at all.
Right.
Or maybe they just haven't gotten caught. So that's the other thing to consider, is that maybe he has done these things and
just
never been tied to anything.
I mean, it'll be wild just if we find out in a couple years that he's tied to like other cases.
Yeah, because then it all makes sense.
Yeah. Well, he's just living this very normal life. In the Kenda show, they referred to him as Mr. Boring Suburbia.
But how many times do we hear that? Like, we've heard that about other killers in the past.
Yeah, that's true. This part is sad, not for him because he's a monster, but I feel badly for his wife. At this time, she had been suffering from stage 4 esophageal cancer.
No, esophageal.
Esophageal? Yeah. I'm honestly not sure if she is still with us today, but we will get back to her in a few minutes.
Probably not if she had stage 4.
Yeah. So now investigators just needed to confirm for 100% that this was their guy. So they needed his DNA. So a fugitive team begins surveilling him. And one day, White stops for lunch at some burger joint. And the team is watching him drink out of this red Solo cup. And I can only imagine that they are holding their breath to see, like, what is he going to do with this cup? Well, White finishes his meal and he gets up. And he walks out, leaving his trash on the table.
Yeah, you know they're going to pounce on that.
100%.
Immediately.
So they get the cup, they bag it, the cup is sent to the lab, and they put a serious rush on these results. They actually got them back in like 2.5 to 3 weeks, which...
That's quick.
Yeah, even Detective Isham is like, to get it back that quickly was absolutely unheard of.
It's true.
Well... the results confirmed what they already knew. Michael David White was for sure the sadistic monster who so viciously murdered Darlene.
Wow.
And I wanted to mention this. Remember how Eric Lord, the one friend of Darlene's,
he was cleared immediately.
Yeah. He said about the guy at the bar, he had, quote, beady eyes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, when detectives showed him the mugshot of White, Eric was like, shocked. He immediately recognized those beady AF eyes.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. He said like they had been in his head haunting him for the last 30 plus years.
Whew.
So on Wednesday, June 12th, 2019, detectives were able to get an arrest warrant for Michael White. The following afternoon, Thursday, June 13th, the entire team, including the Colorado Springs PD detectives, Eisenman Zamosky, Special Agent Veltri, and the Violent Offender Fugitive Task Force, they just like descended on the home of Michael White in Thornton, Colorado, which is
they
like
all
a
wanted in on it.
They Man. All, which I think it's so cool that they all got to be there for it.
They all put the work in. Why not? That's your payoff.
Yeah. So Detective Isham had the honor of cuffing this piece of shit. The arrest was pretty uneventful, which is good, but I do love this part. When they arrested his stupid ass, all the detectives were like, oh yeah, the look in his eyes, he knew this was coming. Like he was just waiting for it.
Not so beady anymore, are you? Like like that Kohlberger. It was nice to see him get the smirk wiped off his face.
You know I love like the idea of a killer who thought they got away with something until that newfangled DNA witchcraft came along.
Yeah.
Like just sitting there with that pit of anxiety in their stomach wondering, when am I going to be caught?
Yeah, because you commit these crimes in an age where this stuff doesn't exist, man. See, this guy not committing any other crimes, you wonder if this one, if he had a moment of just like he lost his shit for a minute and went off on this woman because of something in his life. And it was like he did have like some regret. I don't, maybe that's why he didn't do anything. It messed him up. So he just didn't want to do it ever again.
Yet he stood there and took the time to smoke 3 cigarettes and look at what he had done. Like,
but ew. I mean, I know. I don't know. I don't have an explanation for it.
Me neither. Well, they got this douche in their interview room and he is such a cocky prick.
Cue the excuses. Here he come.
Mm-hmm. So they explain who they are and that they work for Colorado Springs PD. And this idiot is like, did I commit a bank robbery when I was there last year that I don't know about? So police tell him why he's there. And initially he starts talking to them. He tells them that at the time of the murder, he was at Fort Carson. And yes, he did go out to a lot of clubs and bars. And he said he was a very heavy drinker and he hooked up with lots of women, despite being married at the time. But that marriage was quite rocky.
You think? Could it be because you go out to bars and clubs all the time and you're a heavy drinker and you're flirting with lots of women?
Uh-huh. That might be it.
Could be.
Well, his demeanor in the interrogation room, I think it's very telling. He's clearly anxious, which is understandable, but he isn't upset. And while I've never been in that situation, I feel like being accused of a horrifically violent murder, I could be pretty upset.
I would say so.
Yeah. And when they show White Darlene's picture, he looks at it and he goes, "She looks like my ex-wife." It's like such a weird thing to say.
Yeah, but maybe that's, did he have an issue with his ex-wife? I mean, you said that earlier, right?
Hold
that
on.
It was rocky. All right. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'll shut up.
So after he says that, then he goes, "But I know she's not." Yeah, because you know you didn't murder your ex-wife. And not only that, but like the investigators, we talked about this, they believe this killing was so full of rage. And like you just said, we know that White and his ex-wife were on rocky terms. Yep. So was he taking his anger for his ex-wife out on Darlene?
Mm-hmm.
It's a good theory.
Maybe I am a psychologist and I just don't know it.
Or a psycho, one or the other. Well, something that really stood out to me about this case is how a lot of the investigators were kind of blown away by how, like, air quotes, normal this man was.
Yeah.
In the Kenda doc, they even say, quote, "What does he look like? Like the guy behind you at the grocery store. There is no profile. There is no appearance. There is none of that," end quote. Which just reinforces our motto and the wise words of Mama Jeannie. Perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
This is what we're talking about. These guys, you never suspect. And that's the scariest part is I forget what the statistic is. They say you pass in your lifetime on the street, something like 1,000 people who have murdered somebody, which is bananas to me.
I thought it was like 8 people.
All right. Well, hold on. Let me just check. How many killers?
Are like 11.
You pass on the street. All right. Upon further review, you will pass between 16 and 36 murderers in your lifetime.
Yikes. That's still scary.
Yeah. Could be 1,000 if you live in Washington.
Yeah, exactly. Washingtonians.
Anyway.
So I want to go back to his current wife for a second. Like the wife who he was with when he got arrested. I don't know her name. I didn't really look. I didn't want to pull her into too much. But
as I
mentioned earlier, she was very, very sick with stage 4 cancer at the time of his arrest. And again, I'm not entirely sure if she's with us, but apparently she is a lovely woman who was just completely and totally shocked. Rug was literally ripped out from under her. I mean,
how terrible.
She told investigators that White had never been violent with her. He was her caretaker while she was sick.
He's such a strange killer.
Yes. Like, and she even said, like, he was my hero. He was her lifeline. Everything. He was her everything. And when they said that, I just kept thinking, like, and Darlene was everything to her family.
Right. That's a great point.
So, I mean, if Michael White has no remorse for what he did to Darlene, and I doubt that he does, I hope that he has remorse for causing this pain to his wife.
He absolutely does not. And if he does, it's only because he got caught, which means it's not even a real remorse.
Yeah, because he got caught. Exactly.
Right.
Well, it should come as no surprise that this narcissistic a-hole insisted on a trial, despite the glaring DNA evidence. He insisted on dragging Darlene's family, his own family, and the taxpayers through a long and painful trial.
None of this should shock you.
It doesn't. So, trial begins in June of 2021, and the DA talks about how it was tough to find people who were initially involved in the investigation. The forensic tech I mentioned earlier, Charlie Green, had passed away at this point. The medical examiner had passed away. Some of the investigators had passed on as well.
That happens in these old cases, and you really have to rely on, hopefully they took good notes back in the day.
Yes. Well, the DA actually brought back our man Joe Kenda to testify.
Ooh, that's awesome.
So in the Homicide Hunter episode, he talks about how when he walked in to testify, you could hear a pin drop. Like head in that courtroom turned to look at him. And I mean,
he's a celebrity at that point.
It's not every day you see Brad Pitt 2.0.
Get out of here.
The sexiest man alive walking into a courtroom.
I'm going to start cueing the hose and not the crow.
FYI, though, Kenda does make sure to point out that the only person who didn't look at him was Michael.
Was the guy, I'll bet. Yeah.
Yep. So no shocker there. Most of Kenda's testimony was regarding the crime scene evidence, like how it was collected and preserved. It was almost like he kind of testified on behalf of Charlie Green, the crime scene tech, just talking about what a good guy, like how good he was at what he did.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, the deputy DA, a man named Ben Hostetter, he talks about the trial and how he was so nervous, and not for like the high profileness of the crime or being in front of TV cameras or anything like that. He just wanted to do right by Darlene's family.
I feel like he had a strong case, though, with especially with the DNA.
Agreed. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's hard to dispute.
Well, Michael White decides to testify in his own trial. So he sat up there on the stand and whined and moaned that he had never even heard of Darlene Krashock, which is something you and I have been coming across a lot lately. These guilty guys, they try to distance themselves from the crime.
When you're caught, you're caught. So now you need to just, as far as you can get away from that and that evidence, that person, that anything, that's what you're going to do. I think it's just human nature.
But it just sounds so ridiculous. And of course, the DA, the deputy DA, and Darlene's parents are all like, really, you were stationed at Fort Carson when she was killed and you never heard of her? Yeah,
sure, Jan.
Sure, Jan. Exactly. Yeah. Well, then he tries to go on and say that he may have hooked up with her. So his attorneys tried to say that the DNA was just transfer DNA. That's all it was. Because, you know, he had been at the bar with her. So the prosecutors are like, so it just happened to transfer to her body?
It transferred inside her. Yeah.
Exactly. It transferred to the coat hangers and the rope around her neck, and it just transferred to the cigarette butts.
It's lame defense.
It's so bad. And prosecutors are basically like, okay, so there's an unknown killer who didn't get any of his own DNA on Darlene or anything else, but you didn't touch her, and yet your DNA is all over everything.
Yeah, that's one step away from it was self-defense.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the jury deliberated for 3 hours, and on the count of murder in the first degree, we, the jury, find Michael David White guilty.
Nice.
Yeah. And in the Homicide Hunter episode, Darlene's dad, Paul, is talking about this. And as he's saying that line, he just breaks down into tears.
That's so sad.
Yeah. And he's like really this big, tough looking dude. And just to see him break down, you're like, oh, my God, I can't imagine how your heart feels.
It's like it shows you the impact of these cases.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this case haunted so many people.
Yeah, this is a great one for this block.
Yeah. Well, on June 25th, 2021, Michael White's sentencing hearing happened. And at sentencing, Darlene's dad wrote and read an incredibly emotional victim impact statement. And when White was given the opportunity to speak, all he said was, quote, "I didn't kill Darlene Krashock. Nothing else."
Oh,
end quote.
Going to go to his grave. And then he's going to end up telling an inmate or running his mouth at some point. You know, it'll come out.
Can't dispute DNA.
You can try to talk your way around it, but at the end of the day, there were too many other factors involved in this. You can't explain that DNA away.
Exactly. So kind of like the date, there's just another discrepancy that I wanted to mention quick. Some sources, including the Army CID website, they state that Michael White was sentenced to life without parole.
The old LWOP?
Yeah, the LWOP. But A, the Kenda episode says he was sentenced to life with the possibility of parole. And B, if you look at his profile on the Colorado Department of Corrections inmate finder page, it says his sentence is life with parole.
With parole. Interesting. What was the other show on? What other show was it?
Paul is on and Bloodline Detectives with Nancy Grace.
Interesting. Because you have to like annotate all scripts and the lawyers look at that. So I'm surprised if they didn't have source material to back that up.
Yeah, it was very strange how some things say one thing and some things say the other. But
yeah,
also on that page for him, it says estimated mandatory release date, life. So it also has his first eligible parole date is July 2059, when he would be like 98 or 99 years old. So not super worried about him getting out.
But that's good. It's interesting that the facts differ like that and the date of the actual crime. That's bizarre.
Exactly. Because
those are easy things to prove. So I don't know.
Yeah. The only good news is that he will die in prison and nobody will be sad and he'll be forgotten. Whereas Darlene will be remembered and loved. And Kenda ended the Homicide Hunter special by basically saying that this was the most violent sex crime he had ever experienced.
Wow. I believe that. I mean, it's so crazy to me that this was like a one-off for this guy, as far as we know. You know,
I can't. You have to believe that there's more victims out there.
You can almost guarantee it, because you don't just start doing this and then stop doing this. Like, it's, if he was doing it to get off, that's a need that you have to fulfill.
Yes.
You know? So I don't know. I don't think it would have ended with her.
No, I agree. And Colorado has so much wilderness. Like, how do we know there's just people we haven't found yet?
I agree.
So that is the case of Darlene Krashlock, the case that haunted investigators for so many years and so many other people.
Some of those quotes from Kenda, I mean, that guy has seen it all. And that's if he's breaking down and he's sad about something, it shows just how impactful this is. You take this stuff home with you, just like you or me.
Yeah, it definitely messed him up. So that is all we have for today. If you want to talk to us about this case or you have insight on our upcoming Patreon, please feel free to email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. You can hit us up on our socials at murderunscripted. Or you can send us a note through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
Perfect. And yeah, definitely reach out. So now you guys have, what is it, August, September? You have how many months left?
Three.
Five.
November, October, what? Yeah.
3 months it? All right. So you got 3 months.
September, October, November, December. Four.
All right. You we got were four both months. Wrong. 4 months to tell us what you guys want to hear on a Patreon, because otherwise we're just going to start throwing awesome stories at you until we hear otherwise. So it's
exactly
on you.
Exactly.
If you don't like the Patreon, that's on you.
Yeah. Way to go.
Yeah.
Why am I acting like it sucks already? But anyway. Well, we hope everyone has a great night and we hope that you stay safe, stay hydrated.
Do it.
And remember that perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
But they do bump gums.
Yeah, they do. What does that mean? Kenda, tell me.